Welcome to another edition of the Global Lithium Podcast. My guest today is Rodney Hooper. Rodney came on to the lithium scene just a couple years ago. He's done some interesting research, some good writing, and he's someone I've come to respect for both of his ideas and also the way he presents them. He's also the host of a podcast, so instead of me just interviewing him, we ask each other questions. I think you'll enjoy it. But before we get into that, I did want to give a shout out to Lithium Americas and the Minera XR project at Cauchari in Jujuy, Argentina. I posted some photos of the progress they're making despite all the delays caused by the COVID-19 situation. It looks like they've acted in such a way that they'll still be able to go into startup in 2021, and that is certainly good news for the industry. So shout out to everyone involved in that project. After my segment with Rodney, I will come back on and make some follow-up commentary on our discussion. And with that, let's get started with the episode.
This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Zalandez, a brine field services company providing real-time, actionable data that is saving both exploration companies and producers money in both drilling and completion activities. Find them at www.zelandez.com.
Yeah, if you go by PowerPoints, you're going to get poor in this business pretty quickly.
You're listening to the Global Lithium Podcast.
Build stuff and operate stuff. So the attitude here is very much get it done, no BS, very, very much driven by engineers.
This is a very complicated story.
Interesting. Should write a book.
All the people at the Lithium Conference this week, thank you so much for being here so we could go on a family vacation that's close to me.
You guys really leaned into this.
You really made it happen, Dad.
I don't have a Rodney hat, but you, Rodney, you come from a financial background and you have a diversity of experience that I don't have. And I just wonder, what attracted you to this oddball world of the lightest metal?
That's an interesting route, Joe. So in the early to mid 2000s, I had a back to belief on an economic and urbanization super cycle for China. And I went over to Europe and ran a mining book for a few years. And I had a consulting geologist. We used to go all over and kick the tires and do it. And that, you know, worked out well, of course, until the global financial crisis came. And then into the 2010s, I saw the price of renewables dropping. And, you know, my fellow countryman, Elon Musk, launching an EV. But I always had a nagging concern that the oil and auto industry would push back on emission standards tightenings. So I didn't come into lithium earlier. I stuck with doing an oil thesis in 2016 that worked out well. And of course, Dieselgate came in late 2015, which turned everything around. At the end of 2016, I had another look, a critical look at what the genuine threats were to the oil thesis, and came across, you know, the renewables EV again. And this time around, looking at the pricing and looking at the battery tech, I thought, you know, I took a view that lithium ion batteries, a 30-year overnight success, could get the job done. So looking inside the EV battery metal space, you know, you often talk about how battery tech can change. There's one irreplaceable element that was lithium. I was a little cautious where the prices were. You know, I'd read your work and had a look, and you know, prices were well above the marginal cost of production. But I made a view, this is a lithium ion supercycle. I think, you know, there's a massive demand supercycle coming. I wasn't working for an investment bank anymore. I could take my time, and I decided, okay, let me delve into this. I made one schoolboy error in thinking because the industry is small, it wouldn't be complicated. And of course, that's not, as you know, that's not true. And pretty soon it became a 7 day a week, you know, for the last 3.5 years doing it. And then 18 months ago, you know, I tied up with Howard and partnered with Howard Klein and as RK Equity. And, you know, like you, we're hoping to ensure that, you know, lithium wins.
Okay. That, I mean, that last bit was is a good segue to my next question, which is, it's a complicated industry. It's tiny, but it's complicated. So what do you feel are the biggest misconceptions of large and small investors? Because they may be different. I think that's kind of a leading way to ask it. But
yeah, I mean, I think the one central theme, and it was interesting when you had Renee on, is to my mind, both bull and bear investors both underestimate how difficult inorganic chemistry is. You know, so it may not be rocket science, but if you look at the trade data in terms of how many people are actually qualified to sell battery material, and the fact that those standards are only going to get more stringent through time, that's one misconception that I think people have, is they think, anyone can do this. And that's not, you know, that I've learned, you know, the hard way, that's not true. So that's one misconception. The other one I find with investors that they underestimate how long it takes to actually construct, commission, ramp, and then produce and qualify material. So in line with that as well is, you know, OPEX costs and building up a feedstock inventory, et cetera. You know, people have the assumption that you're going to hit cash flows much sooner than you are. And you actually need quite a lot of working capital to be in this business. So that's, you know, another one is timelines. I find people are, you know, if you go by PowerPoint, you're going to get poor in this business pretty quickly. So, you know, that's another one. And then the last one, I think, is how investors look at valuing lithium like other commodities. You know, it just isn't. In the absence of a futures market and a transparent long-term pricing mechanism, you find that funders or investors want a 15 to 20% IRR after tax, at least. And so, you know, what does an NPV8 mean when that's not where funders are going to fund you at, is something that, you know, guys need to lose that misconception and have a hard look at the reality of what funders will want, of what an equity buyer will want. And that's after handicapping based on the risks that I've mentioned as well above.
I think it was a little over 2 months ago, you wrote a LinkedIn piece regarding the case for EVs and it still being intact. I thought that was a really good thought process you went through. You want to just share a little bit about, this was early COVID days, I guess, or right before it. And has anything changed in your thinking other than just the timing, or could you just kind of take us through where you see 2025, you know, the battery packs announcements and any of the things that might be a little different than when you first were writing that?
So, yeah, I mean, my demand number might be slightly off, but I think the key thesis to the EV thematic, Joe, first of all, it's a regulation enabled process. But aside from that, what you wrote, and I think it's probably something that we share, is to my mind, the battery tech is probably ahead of where I thought it would be now. And I think going forward, so I see, you know, the pricing and the energy density and the range, et cetera, and the charging infrastructure as, you know, still in place and intact. So I knew we were going to have a little bit of a hit, although Europe is doing well. I think one still has to factor in that European OEMs will goal seek their sales, because there's no point going below 95 grams on your fleet. Otherwise, you're just wasting credits effectively. So, I think that, that makes me comfortable that we're still headed towards the sort of EV penetration rates by, 5 years from now.
Okay. That's not that it matters, but that's pretty much the way I feel about this, is that this is just a blip in the whole overall story. And, so with all that in mind, with all the conflicting news we have out there, how are you thinking about price right now, short and long term?
So, yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I always chuckle when I see you fight the good fight and people always point to different references. But if you think about it, Joe, and you mentioned it, is, South Korea and Japan import around 120,000 tons. If you strip away some of the technical material, those prices are still north of 10. And that is ultimately what is important. If you look at what actually sells in China and the volume that sells in China, it gets a lot of airtime for something that is a fraction of the market. So if you want to go forward, I have hydroxide tightening at the end of 21, and I have carbonate a year later. So to my mind, if you look at the response, and Max sort of touched on it, if you look at the response of the majors and what they can ramp up in terms of what is available capacity to meet demand, I think it's fairly limited. So, there's going to be, if you funded someone tomorrow, you couldn't get there on time. I don't think we are going to be short. There's just no way around that. So where does price go? I guess you have to factor in a threat. Maybe you can throw your view in here. Is, there is a lot of latent capacity in China, and there is a lot of spodumene inventory in China. So if you look at how much material was exported out of China into the South Korea and Japanese market outside of the major incumbents, it's limited. But is that a risk, or isn't it a risk? What do you think?
Yeah, I find it funny when people talk about China supplying the majors in Japan and Korea, and you look and see, well, it's Albemarle, Livent. And they have China operations. I mean, Ganfeng's really the only other big player there. But I guess when I look at this now, it's going to be interesting how the political realities play out in the next few years with the whole supply chain. I mean, I'm spending a lot of time right now with people involved in trying to build up Europe's capabilities ultimately to have a non-China route as far as the whole battery supply chain. Because, right now people will talk about everything that Europe's doing with batteries, but they're not making any cathode, and they don't, not enough to talk about. And, they've got plans, but it's not that easy. And especially since Europe wants to be the tier one, there's all sorts of risk in this thing right now. And the big point I would make going forward is, we have to see how the politics play out and just see how people are perceived. But when a company like a Ganfeng now, because of U.S. regulations, they can't invest in, say, a Thacker Pass because it'll be blocked. So you've already got, and this was way before the whole brouhaha we're having now happened. So I think because of the concentration of capable supply being in so few hands, the industry is, I won't say completely at risk, but very much at risk. And that's why I feel that, I constantly am goading the car companies on Twitter, which I know is, Don Quixote-ish, but they either need to get their whole supply chain, somebody in that supply chain with deeper pockets than exists now, there need to be at least six big players in my mind. Four isn't enough, especially with Tianqi's tenuous situation right now.
And if you look at balance sheets and you look at, you know, the earnings that we've seen recently, and you know, Paul Graves sort of outlined the maths on their call, you know, and then we get to the reality. If you look at all of the lithium transactions that have gone through in the last 3 years, either these guys are the worst capital allocators in the world, or your new normal has to be, in fact, some of the deals, that's the low end. It doesn't cover the pricing. They need to be higher than that. So they must, do they know something about what it costs to produce, you know, battery quality chemicals outside of China? The maths is saying your new normal has to happen. Otherwise these projects don't fly.
Yeah. I think that the people that, I don't know what Morgan Stanley's logic is for the way they talk about this. Because it's, you know, I get constantly hammered on social media because, well, Morgan Stanley was right. Because everybody knows the price of lithium hydroxide is 7,000 and the price of carbonate is below 6. Well, you can find data to support that. But what you can't find is that even now, you know, if the price isn't going to go below 10, and it, you know, it hasn't yet, on a sustained basis, you'll have individual transactions in Korea and Japan that are below 10, but it's still closer to 12 actually. And I just got the Japan numbers last night for April, and they remain okay. And the other thing that a lot of people don't get is they don't know which transactions are transfer prices, because there is some transfer pricing into Japan and Korea, depending on if companies have a legal entity, they can do that to avoid either VAT or, in the case of Livent, avoid royalties in Argentina, which they clearly do through a Singapore subsidiary that does the paperwork. Sorry, Paul. Anyway, so it's, yeah, if you want to just continue and ask me a few questions, we got 10 minutes left.
Okay, and so I've got one from the lithium legend, Tara Berry. You know,
shout out to Tara Berry, who I'm sure is not listening, or if she is,
she should be. But so her question is, you know, I've seen several reports of a lowering of the lithium cost curve in the coming years from market commentators, banks. It seems counterintuitive that it could fall lower given more difficult product specs and heightened due diligence on sustainability metrics. What are your thoughts on the cost curve in the next few years?
I mean, it's an easy question to answer because I agree with the whole theme. I think, unfortunately, when you look at who does cost curves, a lot of times you get what you pay for, and you're literally paying for your spot on the cost curve, because people's thinking tends to get flexible depending on who's writing the check. And, you know, a lot of times, and you can go back and look at PFS and DFS. I mean, obviously the big guys don't have to do those things because they're not under the same TSX or ASX rules. I mean, Albemarle doesn't have to put out a DFS for a project. That's all internal. But you tend to see costs that are lower than anybody's making now that don't have some kind of technological leverage built in. It's just, our recoveries are going to be 75 or 80% when nobody's doing that. I think if we just look logically, the best resources have pretty much been developed. So logically, the next set of resources aren't going to be quite as good. And if you don't have a new technology, and most of these curves are not predicated on the new technology, it just doesn't make sense that the cost curve moves down. I mean, I will admit that you can make a case right now for converters' costs in China in the short term, with the spodumene price tank to low fours, obviously their costs have come down. But that is not a sustainable event, because the new spodumene players can't survive at a sustained 425 price. That price has got to go up. And, you know, most people also ignore the fact that if a Chinese converter exports, he's got to add that VAT he doesn't get drawback on to his cash cost. So, you know, to me, the spodumene curve is very bifurcated. The brine cost curve is less so. But the other point I'd like to make on the cost curve is that, yes, the best quality hard rock from the best resource with world-class processing is the lowest cost lithium hydroxide. But Livent's much closer to that number than they are to the high-cost number of the high-cost hard rock players with using their carbonate in a carbonate feedstock process. So I think the cost curve's going up, and that's a quick summary of why I think so.
Yeah, I mean, that's a fair call. I'd agree with that. Then the next question I've got is from mine. We had SQM's results come out. They've got a strong balance sheet, but if you look at their gross profits in their lithium division, from 12.9 million from 8.6 in sales and an average price of 7.6, then that equates to an OPEX, including royalties, of about 6.1. So it means that they must be losing on their low price sales in China. So my question is, do they hold on and hope to fix their quality issues, or should they look to do some kind of a reprocessing JV near tier one clients?
Yeah, I mean, I've written a lot about SQM. I've made public statements about SQM. I've owned that stock many times over the last 15 or so years, and I've done very well. But I always had my eyes wide open. They came into the lithium world with a byproduct mentality. They made potash. And the lithium was, their marketing program was, if you didn't like this price, well, you like it at that price. And that price was never as high as this price. And I don't believe that SQM really viewed lithium as a product until the end of 2016, beginning of 17. And then you saw a different behavior than you'd historically seen. Then it was clear they were the high price guy on short-term contracts because the market was crazy. But that, all of that masked the underlying problem that I've talked about for years, is that neither of the brine operators in the Atacama make a very large, maybe it's not 50-50, but it's not much more than that, of what can be used in a battery and what can't. And that was okay in a world where the industrial demand was just as large as the battery demand. You just lot selected, worked out, you didn't worry about it much. Now, trying to expand, they had issues with the expansion, that is clear. I think what they have to do, it's an engineering-driven company, but I think out of that arrogance that, oh, we're all engineers, well, you're all engineers that need to get a clue about how to make battery quality lithium would be my summary to that. And I think they ultimately can right the ship, but I think the way they're talking about it right now is really kind of nonsensical. I don't believe they're going to build 20,000 tons of inventory. And I believe what you're seeing with the low prices in China is indicative of them making a quality that they can't sell. And we saw this happen with Orocobre, with all due respect to our listener in Brisbane. Orocobre sold at a $4,000 to $5,000 premium to Albemarle at many industrial accounts when they first started, when their startup came during the price spike. So they could sell 97% lithium carbonate that didn't meet any spec. They even had to create a new name for it, primary grade. I have just certain people out there that I do business with that buy a significant amount. They were paying Orocobre 13 when they had a contract with Albemarle, but it was a limited volume contract at 8. Those days have totally reversed now. Look at, you know, when Qinghai started producing and they produced enough low-end material that Orocobre's prices crashed more than anybody's, just because low-end product now in a well-supplied market, you couldn't get a premium for a low-end product. And you're seeing the same thing with SQM, with some problems they had during their expansion, creating a higher percentage of low-quality product. It's a long answer to a short question, but yes, I still believe that SQM can possibly right that ship. But the point you made, maybe a good percentage of that has to go to a relationship with a reprocessor. And they also may benefit from this resurgence of LFP, because LFP's battery quality is not the same as battery quality in Korea and Japan. So that they may benefit from that. Okay. What is your thought on that? I mean, obviously you, you know, asked the question, okay. So you've thought about that.
Yeah, look, it seems that the margin is, we know where the high margin product sells. So if you can, you know, looking at, you know, feedback from the industry is what it costs to reprocess. If you can reprocess and then capture the export, you know, the domestic price in Korea and Japan, you know, it makes sense. They've got balance sheet to do it. I mean, they've got 1.4 billion and no one else has really got that kind of cash on hand. Joe, do you stop ramping production and fix, or do you try and, you know, fix on the ramp?
I think we're finding that out right now. And I'm not sure what the answer is, but I mean, I think you, rather than bring a player in China and shipping it over to China, do that. If your process isn't working properly and you don't want to admit it, at least build the reprocessing facility local. But then I don't know again how royalty and what they're thinking about, you know, what they transfer it out at versus where you go in the royalty process. And you have to take a long-term, you have to do those kind of decisions on what the price is going to be 3 years from now and how that runs through the royalty model, not on what happens now. I think this is to be determined. And I'm not smart enough to know what they're going to do, but I think for them to say, or for Morgan Stanley to say, oh, they just decided to go for share in China, it makes absolutely no sense. If the product was of the quality, they'd be, they're foregoing a lot of revenue diverting.
Yeah, I mean, as I say, if you go through the metrics and look at the maths, their average cost is 6.1. So anything selling under that, you're losing. Maybe one last question before we have the...
Robert said he'd give us permission to go a little over. So I guess this is the last question. Sorry, Robert.
So, you know, if you look at what's happening in the US, we're seeing some, you know, some moves into OEM manufacturing. You've got plans, battery plants, LG and GM and Lordstown, SK Innovation. Joe, we've got some cathode production, but when is there... What do you think the likelihood of there being meaningful cathode production in the US?
I think within 5 years there will be. I think it shouldn't take 5 years, but it might. But I think when you're going to see the build out, it just doesn't make sense in my mind. And I know Tesla tried to get Sumitomo Metal Mining 3 years ago to build in the Western United States. And that's from a conversation directly with Sumitomo Metal, not from rumors. And they just said no. But look at what Tesla's done. Tesla's in a much different place now than they were 3 years ago. I think they can bring more influence to bear. And whether it's, if Sumitomo doesn't want to do it, somebody else will. And you have more capability in high nickel, even though it hasn't ramped as fast as people had hoped. You still have more capability there. And Tesla knows a lot of smart guys in the battery field. I think there will be supply for that. And I think there'll be supply, cathode supplies for the others too. It just makes sense. And because you're going to have lithium production here again, ultimately. I mean, you have hydroxide production already, but you're going to go back and I hate to not count Silver Peak, but to me, Silver Peak's running out of inertia, not out of economics. And they have shut it in before. But anyway, I do expect that will happen. It's taken a long time. I mean, I was at the dedication of Toyota's NCA plant built with Obama shovel-ready money early in this last decade. And I think it was early 2012 when I went up there and the governor of Michigan was there. And they had to pay guys to do – I went up there in the summer back like a few months later. And the guys that were supposed to be working in the plant, the guys they brought from Japan, were out making the garden look good because there was no cathode to make. But their agreement with the state of Michigan was to employ people for a certain period of time.
Excellent.
Ultimately, most of my answers end up with a story, so I apologize for
that's,
that.
That's what I'm sure everyone wants to hear.
Okay, well, I guess I'm going to ask you one rapid-fire question. That's a softball. You've already heard it. If you could live anywhere in the world, ex South Africa, where would it be and why?
Well, the first of all, it's not just South Africa, it's Cape Town, sunny Cape Town. Hopefully you'll make your way here sometime, Joe, with the money.
I've been down. It's been a long time. It's been over 20 years.
So I must say my son is going to University of Toronto in September, God willing, with COVID. So I don't know where he'll be staying. So I really enjoyed that city. It reminded me of Cape Town. It's very sort of easygoing and pleasant. And then I've lived in London for nearly 7 years, and that also is a fantastic experience. So possibly one of those two.
Okay. Well, I think with
what
that.
What about you? Outside of, if you had to leave the fine shores of the US, not just moving around from North Carolina, where would you go?
I could easily live in Japan again, happily so, but I couldn't. Working for a company, it's easy to get in. I'd have to go in and out as a non-expat. The other place that I would probably happily live is New Zealand. I've spent some time in New Zealand. I would live on the South Island someplace. And then the other part of the year, I'd go to the other hemisphere. Thanks, Rodney. Appreciate the time.
We would like to thank our sponsor, Zalandez, for bringing this episode of the Global Lithium Podcast to you today. Zalandez prides itself on providing a new way of doing things in the lithium brine space. Are you tired of low confidence data, lack of actionable insights, and multi-day turnaround? Then head to www.zalandez.com to learn more.
It was good to have an exchange of ideas and thoughts on the industry with Rodney. I really appreciate how seriously he thinks about things and how he focuses on the key items. My takeaways were that I liked what he said about projects taking longer than even the bulls or the bears think about it, and you know how that's going to play out as EV demand develops. He made another very salient point about how lithium is different than commodities it's often compared to, and that's a significant differentiation that I'm always trying to make, and I'm glad to see Rodney does too, is that at this point in time, lithium does not qualify as a commodity. Some of the behavior may seem commodity-like, but comparing lithium with an iron ore or copper just doesn't make any sense. I like the way that Rodney characterized the common investor misconceptions. I thought, it's not a term I use very often, but I agree with his lithium ion battery super cycle thinking, and that was really what drew him to the industry. And I also share his thoughts on EV growth, and I think things are actually happening faster than many people thought they would. So it's just good to talk to somebody who thinks deeply about what's going on and isn't focused on the latest Twitter storm. I think at this point in time, we're really just getting too much focus on what I like to call how many angels can dance on the head of a pin arguments, things that don't really matter, or things that are characterized in such a way that it just distracts from the important things investors ought to be looking at. you know, I'm not going to drink any brine anytime soon, and I hope you weren't either. A few more thoughts, come back to some of Rodney's points, is I think if we look at the top five lithium players, only Ganfeng hasn't backed off their growth plans. I mean, you've seen what Albemarle's had to do just really because of their cash flow situation as much as anything else. And, you know, obviously Livent has backed off their expansions. And although SQM talks a good expansion game, if you look at the last 4 years of earnings call statements and other statements they've made at presentations, they just have horrifically underperformed what they said they could do. And then Morgan Stanley's always there to be their cheerleader. So it's been interesting. I think we both agree that despite an overhang of spodumene concentrate in China and what's purported to be excess chemical conversion capacity to demand, I think we really need to revisit those details on another episode. But I think we both agree there's a shortage coming. I talked to another very prominent voice in the industry this week, and he actually told me that he believed my thought that the price would spike in 2022 needed to be moved up to 2021 because I didn't ask for his permission. I'm not going to say who that was, but it's a recognizable name. And ultimately in the future, I'll try to get him back on the podcast. I also enjoyed the Terraberry question on the cost curve. I think if you look at DFS and PFS and some of the cost curve information in those, you really see that people are paying for spots on the cost curve. It's interesting how malleable analysis becomes when there's money involved. But I don't think that you're going to see new capacity come on and just jump to the far left side of the cost curve. And I think the better players and the serious projects don't try to say that. And I think it's kind of the desperation. The people that are not financed have more of a tendency to do that. I mean, especially when, you know, most of the low cost is related to byproduct credits that have spurious origins. So with that, just again, good to talk to Rodney. I'm going to close it out here. Hopefully in the next week or two, I'll do a recording with Nano One and get an update on what they see happening in the LFP space with the Blade and the CTP and some of the work they're doing in that area. Just continue to bring you great guests talking about the meaningful issues of the day and not about whether we're going to have a Phoenix-like rise of Nemaska. And with that, I will say good night and good luck.